pleased to have John Cardy with us, who probably doesn't need much introduction, but he happens to have been the honour of having been a fellow of the All Souls College at Oxford, and I'm glad we informed he shares that honour with Lawrence of Arabia. He has a Wikipedia article about himself with at least four paragraphs. It's John Cuddy.
Oh, hello. Okay. So it's great to be here, and I'd like to thank the PI and in particular Roger for encouraging me to become a DV whatever it is. Okay, so I hope to be here a bit more often in the future. So I want to talk about something that I've had on my mind for the last 25 years or more. Okay, so however, the idea that I should actually give this talk has actually spurred me on to actually thinking about writing it up. So if I have some spare time here, I hope it will appear on the archive sometime in January. So I think in the title that I gave to you, I said RG flows and boundary states in 2D conformal field theories, but then when I was writing it up, I realized actually, although the specific examples that I'll give you are in 2D, in fact, most of what I will be saying can probably be applied to any number of dimensions, so I've removed that restriction in the title. So this all goes back to Ken Wilson's picture of how we understand universality and critical behavior in terms of the renormalization group. So I've drawn a sort of very cartoonish sketch of how we might have renormalization group flows close to an unstable renormalization group fixed point, which is going to be an ultraviolet fixed point in this scheme of things. Of course, there may be. The way I've drawn it here is a projection onto the two-dimensional plane of some multi-dimensional renormalization group flows in some large parameter space, and there may well be flows into this fixed point also, but I'm going to be trying to consider what happens on the manifold of unstable flows away from this ultraviolet fixed point, and those in general correspond to renormalizable quantum field theories. So here I've drawn an example where there are various relevant renormalization group flows. And these can either flow into some other renormalization group X point, which can either have directions of stability and also instability. But ultimately, all these renormalization group flows, except maybe some kind of set of measure zero, are going to end up in these renormalization group sinks, which I've indicated by the open circles. So those are sort of fixed points of the renormalization group, but they're kind of trivial ones in that actually at the fixed point, the actual theory doesn't have any content, right? So what we would like to do, however, is to have some knowledge of the conformal, well, each renormalization group X point or each non-trivial one, assuming that we're talking about a relativistically invariant problem, is going to correspond to a conformal field theory. Let's suppose we have data about that conformal field theory, data about the renormalization group flows nearby. That means basically a list of relevant operators there, and the scaling dimensions or the renormalization group eigenvalues corresponding to those relevant operators. Then if we move a little better way, then each point on each of these generic renormalization group flows is going to correspond to some massive renormalized quantum field theory. And the point is, what we would like to do is to understand which, that if we go off in a particular direction with some particular linear combination of relevant operators, to which renormalization groups sync do we flow? Along the way, this is going to correspond to some renormalized massive quantum field theory. What is it? And so this is a very generic kind of a problem. So just to give you almost the simplest possible example, if we look at the phase diagram of the Ising model, there is where this is the temperature axis, this is the external magnetic field. Then there is a critical point at a particular temperature and in zero magnetic field. And in the same picture, which is really a picture of the phase diagram, okay, we can imagine the projection of the renormalization group flows, and basically they look more or less the way that I've drawn here, depending on how you actually implement the renormalization group. But if you're at zero field and the temperature is higher than the critical temperature, you flow into a sink, which is the infinite temperature, zero field case. If you look at zero field and T less than Kc, you flow into zero temperature, which you can think about from some points of view as a renormalization group group fixed point, but it won't be in the sense that I'm talking about here. I mean, it doesn't correspond to a conformal field theory. Or if you turn on a non-zero magnetic field, depending on the sign of the magnetic field, you flow to an infinitely strong, this is supposed to be at H equals infinity or H equals minus infinity. So all the points around here are basically in the same phase. It corresponds to a phase with a finite correlation length and a non-zero magnetization. And if you wanted to evaluate what the magnetization was at a particular point here, you would just integrate up the renormalization group flows all the way into the infinitely ordered magnetic, infinitely strongly ordered point, at which point you know what the magnetization is. So there is the idea that there is somehow a correspondence between these renormalization group sinks, which is what I've indicated by the open circles, and the possible phases of the model. So the general problem that I would like to address, first of all, as a lattice problem, is if we have a renormalization group fixed point with an RG Hamiltonian, RG fixed point Hamiltonian H star, we add a bunch of relevant operators, call them phi j, with coupling constants gj. Where do the renormalization group flows end up for different values of the relevant couplings? What is therefore the phase diagram in the vicinity of the critical point? Because if I go back to the picture here, you see that these renormalization group sinks are then going to be separated by these boundaries, which are essentially phase boundaries. And these boundaries themselves will actually be close to the fixed point, will be renormalization group flows themselves, because the flows can't obviously cross a phase boundary. So we would like to understand how do these phase boundaries, or the boundaries between the different renormalization group sinks, come into this unstable fixed point here. So it's a general question of how do we relate ultraviolet physics and infrared physics, which is sort of basically what we're doing all the time, trying to understand the infrared in terms of the ultraviolet, the problems of emergence and so on. So from the field theory perspective, as I said, each RG fixed point corresponds to a CFT, and now I'm going to be talking about the CFT as a quantum field theory. That means I'm actually going to be talking about real operators acting on a Hilbert space. So now I'm going to be thinking about the Hamiltonian operator of the quantum field theory as being a perturbation of that for the CFT by a bunch of fields now, which are continuous fields, and now the coupling constants lambda j are going to be dimensionful and proportional to those GJs that I talked about before on the lattice. And as I said before, every relevant flow line ending at a sink corresponds to a massive quantum field theory, and we would like to understand more about what that massive quantum field theory is, what its spectrum is, so on. Okay. It's important to realize that no matter where you are on each line going towards the sink, it's actually in the continuum limit, it's the same quantum field theory. It's just that the basic scale is changing, but they are all isomorphic to each other as you flow along an RG trajectory. And of course, this is a hard problem in general. And in general, even though I give you information close to the RG fixed point, it generally requires non-perturbative methods. One kind of method which has been used is, at least which works in 1 plus 1 dimensions, is if the perturbation happens to be integrable. And then if it's integrable, which I won't really define what that means, but if it is, then you can make a guess, at least, as to what the spectrum of the massive quantum field theory is. You can make a conjecture as to what the S matrix is, and so on. But apart from that, unless you're going to do numerical approaches, for example, on the lattice, then this is, in general, a hard problem. So I'm going to suggest a rather simple approach to this hard problem, which is not going to give us exact results, but which is going to give us a good qualitative picture of what's actually going on. And that is by studying the boundary states corresponding to the particular conformal field theory, which corresponds to the ultraviolet X point. So the idea is that every conformal field theory has a set of possible boundary conditions that we can impose on that conformal field theory, which is somehow consistent with the conformal invariants. In fact, you can think of these so-called conformal boundary conditions as themselves fixed points of renormalization group flows, but renormalization group flows in the space of all possible boundary conditions. And one way to characterize these conformal boundary conditions is to think about quantizing the theory on a time slice, as I already indicated that I would do, talking about the Hamiltonian. So we have these states defined on each time slice. So you can think of the boundary itself as being on a constant time slice. And then the boundary condition corresponds to a particular boundary state in the Hilbert space, or hopefully in the Hilbert space. As I'll mention later, that's not quite true. But then the condition that it be a conformal state is that it's actually reparameterization invariant, and that tells you that the momentum density operator, which is this particular component, a time-space component of the energy momentum tensor acting on this state, actually vanishes. So this is a condition whereby we actually pick out the conformal boundary states of the CFT, and this is a program which has been carried through to almost completion in 1 plus 1 dimensions. In higher dimensions, it's not particularly well understood unless you have a free theory or a weakly coupled theory. So for strong coupling CFTs, we don't really understand how to impose this, but in principle, it's there. Any questions so far? Yeah.
Can you go back?
Yeah, sure.
So this condition is, next one, please. This K is an index.
that is not.
So K is a spatial index, right?
So it's in B plus 1, so say 2.1.
This will be T0.1. T minus T bar.
So only in one direction, orthogonal to the boundary, or?
No, so the direction orthogonal to the boundary, because I've chosen the boundary to be a constant time hypersurface, right? So the direction to the boundary is the time, zero, okay?
Oh, the boundary is in the time direction.
The boundary is perpendicular to the...
Perpendicular, so in 2 plus 1 we still have...
a space direction, yeah.
One space direction with this...
One space and one time, yeah. Okay.
So yeah. That K is that space direction.
Yes. There's only one, but so K labels, K goes from 1 up to capital D. Okay. I'm talking about capital D space dimensions, one time. Okay.
So you mean for all K?
For all K, yes. For all K. Sorry. Yes, it wasn't clear. Okay, but it's for okay. So we therefore the conjecture that I want to make is that the conformal boundary states also label the possible sinks of the bulk renormalization group flows. And the way this works, for example, in the case of the Ising model, is that when we try and work out what the conformal boundary states are, there are only three of them which we can physically interpret in terms of the spins of the Ising model as the spins being free at the boundary. That is, or there's an infinitely strong magnetic field acting on the boundary so that they're all fixed to be all plus or all minus. That's the microscopic description of these conformal boundary states. And as you see, they're in one-to-one correspondence with the renormalization group sinks. So I don't have a great deal of evidence for this conjecture. It works in examples that I know. There are other 1+1 dimensional examples where we understand the CFT, where we understand all the relevant operators, and where we also understand all the conformal boundary states, and it appears to work. But whether it's true in general, I'm sure that you can probably find a counter example. But at least it's a place to start in trying to describe the non-perturbative physics in terms of what we know about the ultraviolet theory.
So what would be the physical motivation behind this conjecture? What is the physical motivation?
Okay, so we understand what happens in the Ising model, right? So, but I give you some conformal field theory and I tell you to turn on some linear combination of relevant operators. That is, I move away from this unstable fixed point. What is the physics along that renormalization group flow? So it's a very general question, very important question. For example, if we're talking about QCD, we have an ultraviolet fixed point, which is the zero coupling fixed point. You turn on the coupling. At strong coupling, you have the whole spectrum of hadrons and everything. So in principle, it's that kind of a question.
No, okay. The question is, why do you expect the fixed points of the bulk to be labeled by the boundary states? Like, what would be the connection between boundary states and fixed points.
Okay, that you get to these. Okay, so that you can get to these different conformal boundary states by turning on operators at the boundary. That is, you flow between these different boundary states by doing that, for example, by turning on a magnetic field here at the boundary. I can flow at the boundary from the free boundary condition to the plus one, right? Mm-hmm. So if I do the same thing in the bulk, this is going to correspond to some particular linear combination of relevant operators in the bulk. So then where do I flow to? Okay, so there is going to be a correspondence there, some kind of bulk boundary correspondence.
But maybe if I can comment, it's only the boundary state satisfying this constraint. It is a spatial, it's the Morphson constraint. And these things, they correspond to systems which kind of satisfy space-time symmetry. So it seems to be that, you know, somehow if you have a boundary state that satisfies spatial diffeomorphic symmetry, then it might can flow to something which satisfies the full space-time diffeomorphic symmetry.
May I go on? Yeah, okay. So we can rephrase the question as, which boundary state best approximates the ground state of the perturbed Hamiltonian at strong coupling? So the idea is that these renormalization group flows flow to strong coupling, and the Hamiltonian is going to have some kind of ground state, and that ground state is going to be somehow close to a boundary state. That's the idea. So, however, there's a problem with that immediately, in that the conformal boundary states themselves, being reparameterization invariant themselves, have no scale. So the actual ground state of this perturbed Hamiltonian corresponds to the ground state of a massive quantum field theory. It does have a scale, but in the strong coupling limit, once again, this scale has gone away. So what we really want to actually do is to be at some point, sort of halfway along one of these renormalization group trajectories, think about the ground state of the Hamiltonian here, and try to then start from a boundary state here, which has no scale, somehow perturb that boundary state, and try to match that perturbed boundary state onto the perturbed CFT here. So that's what we really want to try to actually do. So we want to have a reasonable way of perturbing the boundary states in order to give them a scale. And there's a particular way of doing that, and it's not the only way, but it's a way that you can actually end up doing reasonable calculations, which is that we consider what I call these smeared boundary states. So we take the conformal boundary state, which has no scale. We then evolve it in imaginary time tau with the conformal field theory Hamiltonian. And then it's going to have a scale which is proportional to tau. And it's actually going to have a finite energy and a finite correlation length. So one way to, one perhaps more familiar way to think about this is a continuum version of a matrix product state. So in the diagram on the left, I have imaginary time running upwards, space running across. I start from my conformal boundaries out here, I evolve with my conformal field theory Hamiltonian for an imaginary time tau, and I ask what state do I get to here. Now, if I discretize this problem on a spatial lattice and a time lattice, then I get something like that, okay, which, so, and then I block it in these blue blocks, and you can then recognize this as some kind of a matrix product state where the internal degrees of freedom of the matrix are represented by the rows here. So maybe that's a better way of understanding it. We are looking at a gapped quantum system corresponding to this perturbed conformal field theory. We are going to use this smeared boundary state as a trial sort of matrix product state, and we're now going to actually adopt a variational approach. We're actually going to use this state as a trial state for the energy, to minimize the energy of the perturbed Hamiltonian.
Jeff?
Yeah.
This smear boundary state at short distances already looks like the CFD ground state.
Yes, right? Yes, which is one reason why it's good.
Yeah, it's good, but it would have divergent entropy.
Its entanglement entropy grows in 1 plus 1 dimension, grows like log of tau.
Yeah, but the short distances.
And it has the same divergence.
It has a divergence.
Yeah, because
yeah,
it's...
That's fine. I'm saying in comparison with matrix product state.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, that's because I have a continuum here. So once, because a matrix product state, you've discretized in space, right? So
okay. Yeah. It's just that there is a continuous version of matrix products.
Oh no, I think I'm sorry.
No, I
don't think this is the same as what you guys call continuous matrix product states.
Right.
It's different. Okay.
This one is not uregularized, and that's a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Any more questions? So there's a motivation for why I got back to looking at this problem, which is a completely different kind of a physics problem, which is a problem of quantum quenches. So the quantum quench problem is a problem about dynamics in quantum field theories, in many-body quantum systems. So the idea in a quantum quench is that you prepare some many-body quantum system, some quantum field theory, in a state psi zero, which is translationally invariant in general, but it's not the ground state of the Hamiltonian H with which you're going to evolve the system. Okay, so you would like to know, if you start with a state which has extensive energy above the ground state of your Hamiltonian, how does that evolve? Well, it evolves according to the laws of quantum mechanics, in particular, because you start with a pure state, psi zero, you will always remain in a pure state, but nevertheless, is there a sense in which you can achieve a stationary state? And that can happen if you look at a finite subsystem of the whole system. So is there a sense in which subsystems reach a stationary state? And if so, what is it? This was motivated beginning about 10 years ago, when people could actually do experiments on ultra-cold atoms, where they were precisely looking at this kind of coherent quantum evolution in many body systems. And my postdoc at the time, Pasquale Calabresi, and I decided to look at this problem in a model that we could actually solve, which was where this thing was one of these smeared boundary states that I'm talking about that actually has a finite correlation length, and where we evolve with the conformal field theory Hamiltonian. And what we showed, and to actually convince you of this would actually take a seminar in itself, is that if you look at a subsystem, it does indeed achieve a stationary state in that its reduced density matrix becomes time independent, and moreover it thermalizes in the sense that the reduced density matrix is that of a thermal ensemble. And although we chose this very particular theory, a conformal field theory, one of these smeared boundary states as the initial state, it turned out that a lot of the physics that came out of this was much more general. It could be seen as the propagation of entangled EPR pairs moving to the right and the left from this initial state. So what was missing from our original analysis was precisely this question: okay, so how do we choose the particular boundary state in order to mimic the particular physics of the system that we are looking at? Suppose we're looking at a system of cold atoms, which is forming some kind of optical lattice, but on large distances, the fluctuations are described by some kind of a quantum Hale theory, and we start in a state which is the ground state of some gapped Hamiltonian, then which boundary state do we choose to best imitate the properties of the ground state of this gapped Hamiltonian? So that encouraged me to sort of get back into this question, and so now what I'm going to do, unless there are any questions about quantum quenches, I'm going to get back to the problem. Yeah.
Well, it's a more basic question, actually. The boundary states, say ground states, they live in the same Hilbert space, right?
Yes. This is the Hilbert space of the theory. Perhaps okay. I have to quantize it on a ring or something. You know, yes, with.
Okay.
With.
Could you say some words on what defines these boundary states? What's a boundary state?
The thing that defines the boundary states is the condition that I wrote down before, that the reparameterization invariant, that is the zero, the time-space component of the energy momentum tensor acting on them. Okay, so now what we're going to do is just regard these boundary states as variational trial states for the ground state of our gapped Hamiltonian. And if you didn't want to bother about everything that I've said up to now, you could just say, okay, here we have a perturbed conformal field theory where we believe it has a gap. How can we get a good trial state for its ground state? So what we're going to do is, let's assume that we can enumerate with this index A all the possible conformal boundary states. It turns out these, well, because the condition on the boundary states is a linear one, that they're annihilated by the space-time component of T, they obviously span a subspace of the whole Hilbert space. Okay, so let's suppose BA is a basis of that space, and as I'll indicate, there are actually particular states in that subspace which correspond to physical boundary states. In general, a linear combination of physical boundary states is not physical, and I'll explain that, I hope, in a moment. So let's suppose that we have this basis of physical conformal boundary states, which we smear each of them by a parameter tau A, and we take an arbitrary linear combination of them as a trial state. So what we want to do is to work out the expectation value of the perturbed Hamiltonian with respect to this trial state and minimize it regarding the alpha A's and the tau A's as variational parameters. So what we have to do is to work out the norm of this state, which is going to involve the overlaps between the BAs and also the matrix elements of the unperturbed Hamiltonian and the perturbation. So this is just standard variational quantum mechanics.
Are you assuming here some perturbation? Is this a perturbative analysis in the sense of
a variational analysis?
It's variational, but
as you know, is the same as first order perturbation theory in weak coupling, but it's not in general, right?
Okay, so the Hamiltonian that you're interested in is the small perturbation.
No, because
the system is large and.
The system is large. These are relevant perturbations. If you do straightforward perturbation theory, because they're relevant, the terms blow up. Okay. So let's just work out the normalization. So we want to work out what is the overlap between this smeared boundary state, this smeared boundary state. And if we think about this as a path integral calculation, it's just the partition function on some annulus, right? So this is space, this is imaginary time, we're evolving for an imaginary time tau I plus tau b. We have a boundary condition BA here, a boundary condition BB here. And if we have periodic boundary conditions in space, this is an annulus. Except I'm going to always assume that the size of my space L is much bigger than anything else. So it's really a very, very long strip. Okay? So this is basically the partition function with boundary conditions A and B. Now, if A were equal to B, this is just like the Casimir energy between two plates. That is, if you think about, instead of having time running this way, space running this way, you have time running along the strip, then this is going to be given by the ground state energy of the Hamiltonian that generates translations along the strip. And this Casimir energy, which is going to be the ground state of that Hamiltonian, is going to scale like some universal number sigma A times L to the D, because this is really D space dimensions. I've only been able to draw one there. And because it's scale invariant, being in a CFT, it must go like 1 over tau A, also to the D. So if A equals B, this is what the normalization of the states is going to be. But if A is not equal to B, that is, if these are different physical states, then there is going to be some kind of interface in between them. For example, in the IC model, if I choose plus boundary conditions here, minus boundary conditions here, there has to be an interface there. That interface is going to have an energy proportional to L to the D. And that's going to, and what you can show, because of convexity, that this energy is always going to be exponentially smaller than this. So this tells us that in this large L limit, we can ignore the overlaps when A is not equal to B. That's only true if A and B are what I call physical states. In 2 plus 1 dimensions, sorry, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, there's a very clear way of designating what we actually mean by these physical states. I would say in higher dimensions, it's not really understood yet, but one way of actually saying what we mean by a linear combination of boundary states being physical is precisely this idea that when you choose two different ones, the partition function is much smaller, that there is an interfacial energy in between them. So I'm going to say that the off-diagonal terms are suppressed, and that's also going to be true in the numerator too. So that actually makes the problem a lot simpler because it's a diagonal problem. Okay, so actually viewed as a perturbation, this is actually a diagonal perturbation. All right. So basically, the problem's getting easier and easier. The variational energy is going to be diagonal in the A's. The expectation value of the Hamiltonian is just going to be this Casimir energy here. And then the perturbation is just going to be the one-point function of this perturbing operator in this strip here. So in order to get the expectation value of the perturbation, we just look at the same picture, but with A equals B, we stick a phi j in the middle, and we write down the one-point function, which is this thing. And this one-point function, because this operator phi j has a dimension delta j, must scale like 1 over the width to the delta j. And what's going to be in here is an amplitude, some universal amplitude called ajA. So basically, in this whole calculation, the only things that we don't know are the sigma a's, but we can get that out of the conformal field theory if we understand it well, and also the ajA's, which are the one-point functions. All right. So because this is diagonal in the alpha a's, it's obvious that the absolute minimum is always going to occur when all of the alpha j's are zero apart from one, because they have to sum up to one. So what we need to do to find the absolute minimum is to look at these terms for each boundary state A, minimize this expression with respect to tau A, and then choose the A for which the minimum is the smallest. Okay, and then as we move around in the phase diagram, as we vary the lambda j's, as we vary how we're moving away from that unstable fixed point, the value of A, which gives us the minimum, the absolute minimum, is going to change. And that's going to map out the phase diagram or the renormalization group sinks as we move away from the x point. Now, when you stare at this, it's not obvious that there is even going to be a minimum, but actually what I can show, at least in the examples, that we understand that this is always going to be the case. Because we have relevant perturbations, the scaling dimensions are always less than the space-time dimension. That tells you that as tau A goes to zero, this thing is terminating, and because the Casimir coefficient is always positive, then this goes to plus infinity for small tau A. Now, as tau A goes to infinity, it's going to be dominated by the J with the smallest delta J, and that coefficient could be negative, or that is, these coupling constants here could be positive or negative, but what you can show is whether the lambda J is positive or negative, you can always find some A such that the combination lambda J, AJA, is negative, so it always approaches zero from below, so there has to be a minimum. Okay, so there are some A's for which there is going to be a minimum. We have to find the A which gives us the minimum. Okay. I won't say any, well, this is kind of cute. Let's suppose we have found for some particular set of couplings what the minimum is, and it corresponds to a particular A. Now, this function here has an interesting rescaling under rescaling the couplings by this amount and rescaling tau by that amount. So if we found the minimum particular A for a particular set of lambdas, if we rescale the lambdas, which just corresponds to moving along a renormalization group trajectory, it's going to happen for the same A. That's a good thing. It would be bad if that weren't true. It means that as we move along this RG trajectory, the minimum is always going to correspond to the same A, to the same sink. Okay, now, I'm going to briefly say what kind of calculations we can actually show here. So I'm going to talk about results in the two-dimensional minimal conformal field theories. These are unitary 2D CFTs with a central charge smaller than one. They're extremely well understood. We understand all the scaling dimensions. They correspond to physically interesting models. The bulk operators are labeled by entries in this rectangular grid, in this finite rectangular grid called the CADS table. And there's a particular set of these unitary models called the diagonal models, for which each value in the CADS table occurs exactly once. That is, we can make a list of all the operators in the theory, and each one occurs once. We can also identify all the physical boundary states, and one of the interesting results, which was shown 27 years ago, or right a long time ago, was that the entries in the CATS table also label the physical boundary states too. So we would like to understand by turning on a particular operator, bulk operator, corresponding to a particular entry in the CATS table, what boundary state or what sync corresponding to which boundary state do we turn on? That is, which boundary states give us the lowest variational energy for the conformal field theory perturbed by a particular set of bulk operators. All right. So in order to do that, we need to know what these one-point functions are. They are given explicitly in terms of what's called the modular S matrix of the CFT. There's a particular explicit representation here. And the important thing about these S's is that they form the elements of an orthogonal symmetric matrix. And that tells you all kinds of interesting properties. It tells you, for example, that we can always choose an A for which we can find a minimum. But it also says that if we want to aim at a particular boundary state, that is, you can ask the question, is there a particular linear combination of bulk operators so that we're going to go to a sink corresponding to a particular boundary state? The answer is yes. And that relies on the fact that these form the elements of an orthogonal matrix, and therefore the rows and columns are orthogonal. I won't go through that, but it's a simple case. So let me just give you the example of the Ising model, just to see whether we can reproduce that phase diagram. So there were three functions. There are, in that case of the Ising model, here's the CFT. There are two relevant operators, one corresponding to the energy density couples to little t, which is t minus tc. The other is the magnetization, which couples to the external magnetic field. There are, in fact, three bulk operators in the CATS table, because there's also the identity operator. Of course, perturbing with the identity operator doesn't do anything particularly interesting. So there are three primary operators, and therefore, correspondingly, there are these three boundary states which we can identify with plus boundary conditions, minus boundary conditions, and free. And then when we work out these functions CA, they look something like this. So for each C, we have to minimize this function with respect to tau. And then for a particular values of T and H in the phase diagram, we have to choose the particular C which gives us the lowest minimum, okay? So it's quite easy to see that if T is positive and H equals zero, free wins and so on. But there is a problem, and I'll tell you what the problem is, because we have to be honest here. Okay, so here's a picture of the renormalization group flows in the vicinity of the unstable fixed point. And I've scaled them so that H to the 8 over 15 scales like T. That's just because of the particular exponent 15 over 8 in the Ising model. So if I just plotted this with H versus T, these are not straight lines, they're curved. So I've just rescaled the coordinates so that all the RG flows away from the fixed point are straight lines. So we have in this whole region here, all the way above negative T, we flow to the plus boundary condition. Similarly here, we flow to the minus one. If we start with H equals zero and positive T, we flow to the free boundary condition. But the problem is that there is some finite opening angle here for which we also, even if we turn on a small magnetic field, we still flow to the free boundary condition. Instead, what we should be doing asymptotically is flowing around here somewhere. Okay, so this is a defect of this particular variational approach. It's true that we can, for any particular sink, we can find a combination of bulk operators such that we flow to that sink. But if you go a little bit away from that particular combination, you can show that you always still flow to the same sink. So this is typical of kind of variational approximations in critical behavior. As you go from here to here, you go from one trial variational state to another, and there's essentially a first order phase transition. So this approximation would suggest that in the phase diagram of the icing model, there is a line across which there's a first order phase transition, which we know, of course, is not true. This phase is, in fact, when you go around here, is continuously connected. So, well, that's bad then. So this gets too, instead of a smiley, it gets too frownies. But you can then go ahead and apply this to generalizations of the icing model, which I won't talk about, which are the so-called AMRSOS models, which are lattice models, which are realizations of these conformal field theories. And you get certain things that actually do make sense. That is, you can identify the bulk operators which switch on a particular boundary condition. And it's always a particular linear combination of bulk operators which in general does so. Even though the number of boundary conditions is the same as the number of bulk operators, they're both labeled by positions in the CATS table. It's not true that turning on one bulk operator gives you one particular boundary condition. Okay, and one thing that I've swept under the rug is that, in fact, I'm doing a variational bound for the ground state energy of a quantum field theory. And that's an ultraviolet divergent object. Now, there are ultraviolet. Okay, so we've already assumed that in the conformal field theory, we've already set the ground state energy equal to zero. So we've already got rid of the worst of the divergences. We're turning on a relevant perturbation, which corresponds to what we would in field theory think about a super renormalizable theory. So in general, if you look at correlation functions, you don't introduce new ultraviolet divergences, but nevertheless you do in the ground state energy. And you can actually see this if you just calculate in, let's suppose that we turn on a single operator, and we just calculate in perturbation theory the change in the ground state energy. Well, it's it's just given by an integral over the two-point function, which is basically this. And you can see this is divergent at short distances if delta is larger than 1. Here we're in 1 plus 1 dimensions. So even though the operator is relevant, that is, delta is smaller than 2, if delta happens to be larger than 1, there are going to be ultraviolet divergences in the quantity that we're trying to actually place an upper bound on. Moreover, you can see these are actually negative. So relative to the energy of the conformal field theory, the ground state energy of the perturbed theory is minus infinity. And we're trying to put an upper bound on minus infinity, which is not a very good thing to do. Well, in field theory, we know how to get around these kind of infinities. And what we have to do is basically introduce a counter term in the variational energy, which is going to be of the form 1 over epsilon. So it goes, epsilon is the short distance cutoff. It diverges as epsilon goes to 0. And then it must scale with this variational parameter tau in this particular way. So in the variational energy, we have to include a term like this. This slightly modifies the variational calculation, but not in a particularly important way. And for example, you can show that in the case of the Ising model, this gives rise to the well-known logarithmic anomaly in the specific heat. So we do actually reproduce that. So just to summarize, I apologize for running over slightly. These smeared boundary states, in examples that we understand, give us a simple way of understanding the endpoints of relevant renormalization group flows. It's a variational approximation, so it certainly gives you a rigorous upper bound on the free energy. And in the what I haven't mentioned is that you can compare this with exact results from integrable models where the free energy is known exactly. And apart from making sure that you get the factors of 2 pi right and understanding whether the Russians who wrote the papers on the integrable models also got their factors of 2 pi right, then it seems to work pretty well. So, but we do have this problem that this variational state is too crude. It can't get all the fine detail. Well, it can't even get some of the gross detail of the phase diagram completely right. We could certainly improve this variational state by not perturbing it with the e to the minus beta h, but adding some more terms there. That is, for example, in the case of the Ising model, we can take this free boundary. We can perturb it with a small boundary magnetic field. This is precisely what is missing here. That would make sure that it had a non-zero magnetization when we turn on a small field. But then the calculation gets much harder, much harder. I mean, so this is an example of an approach where you can sort of get gross features of the physics out pretty easily, and to improve it, you have to work a lot harder, but in principle, it can be done. So I think I'll stop there. And thank you for your attention. Any? Yeah.
So if you flow from, say, tricriticalizing to Ising.
Yes.
So do you know what is the boundary state that you
need? Yeah, yeah, well, that's precisely one of the things that it doesn't get right, because all these boundary states, these smeared boundary states, always all have finite correlation length. Okay, so it so you only smear to
get.
So you only go to cap states. When you look at what actually happens there, yeah, and you go through this calculation, what it's trying to do is to go to some linear combination of states, which is a linear combination of the up state and the down state, I believe. But it doesn't go to a free state or an Ising state or some other particular state. So already it's at that level. It is getting things wrong. If you flow in the other direction towards the first order transition, it does seem to get the physics right, but yes.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank John again.